Welcome to the Tuesday Sports Show.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much for listening to the ORN Sport on this Tuesday evening. We will be discussing over the next hour all the sports news from the past week and previewing what's to come over the next 7 days.
Murray wins! Murray wins it all! This is going to be a top play.
Is URN Sport.
Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of the Tuesday Sports Show. I'm your host Ollie Roberts, and joining me today in the studio we have the ever-present Matt Webb, Jack Ellis and Sam Lewis.
The ever-present, I like yep. that.
Join us as we'll be discussing the events which unfolded in the Six Nations this weekend, GB's display in the Davis Cup, as well as England's up-and-coming T20 series against Australia and New Zealand. To start with though, we're going to move to undoubtedly the biggest sporting event of the week, despite it only being the second best form of football. Super Bowl 52 took place on Sunday. The match saw New England Patriots chasing their sixth title against the Philadelphia Eagles in Minneapolis. After last year's extraordinary comeback against the Atlanta Falcons, nobody assumed this year's final would be quite so dramatic. But what ultimately occurred has been hailed as one of the best finals of all time. I'll now hand over to Jack, who's going to give us a summary on how events unfolded on Sunday night.
Yep, Super Bowl 52 saw the New England Patriots, led by recently crowned NFL MVP Tom Brady, face off against perennial underdog Philadelphia Eagles, led by backup quarterback Nick Foles. The game started fairly slowly. Long drive by the Eagles resulted in a 25-yard field goal by rookie kicker even Jake Elliott. New England answered in kind, Stephen Gostkowski getting three for the Patriots. The first touchdown of the game went the way of Philadelphia. A three-play drive from the restart, helped by a 36-yard run from LeGarrette Blount, and the touchdown pass, a 34-yard effort from Foles to Alshon Jeffrey. The extra point was missed, though, leaving it 9-3 to the men in Midnight Green. The Pats' next drive took them to the Eagles' 11-yard line, and with that came the end of the first quarter. That drive, however, came up empty, Gostkowski's field goal effort failing due to a muffed snap by holder Ryan Allen. The only punt of the game came on Philly's next effort, New England's defence forcing a three and out, and on the drive that resulted from that, Tom Brady made a 23-yard pass to Brandon Cooks, who got absolutely flattened by Philadelphia safety Malcolm Jenkins to the extent that he was not allowed to rejoin the game. He was out like a light, man. That was a big hit. A trick play was attempted, setting up Tom Brady as a wide receiver, although unfortunately somebody forgot to tell him that while he is 40, he isn't Jerry Rice, and that pass got dropped. The Eagles got the ball on their own 35 thanks to a turnover on downs, which turned into points at the other end thanks to 41 yards on two catches and another run-in from LeGarrette Blount, who incidentally featured for the Patriots in last year's Super Bowl. The two-point attempt fell incomplete, and it was 15-3. Brady then started to flex his MVP muscles on the next drive, nailing a 45-yard pass to Rex Burkhead. However, the Philadelphia defence stood firm and held the Pats to only two more yards, forcing another field goal. 15-6 with 7 minutes 30 left of the half. The Eagles looked absolutely certain to score another touchdown on the ensuing drive, but a tip interception led to another New England possession, this one resulting in a touchdown to running back James White. Gostkowski again missed another kick. This was quite surprising given how accurate he's been all year. There was, I think, three or four missed kicks or attempts at point after made in the game. The Eagles made their final possession of the first half count, the restart being returned to their 30-yard line, the drive taking them all the way to the New England one. They were looking to be set for a play. Doug Pederson called a timeout and then decided to call one of the gutsiest plays in Super Bowl history, a move they called the Philly Special that was actually practiced in the ballroom of the hotel where they were staying so as to not get any media attention. The ball was snapped directly to tight end Trey Burton after some misdirection by Foles, who was pretending to audible to his lineman, who caught the touchdown pass, which made him the first quarterback ever to do so in a Super Bowl. The extra point was good, and following a short Patriots drive, the teams went to the locker rooms with the Eagles holding a 22-12 lead. At the start of the third quarter, Tom Brady remembered the existence of star tight end Rob Gronkowski. He'd only caught one pass in the first half at all, when you consider he's a 6'6" tight end with massive hands. It's a miracle it took him that long. To whom he passed five times for a total of 68 yards, the last one a 5-yard touchdown to make it 22-19. It became very much a back-and-forth affair from then on, the Eagles running an 85-yard drive, resulting in a touchdown, to which the Patriots responded with a 75-yard touchdown drive. The Eagles took their possession to the New England 16-yard line upon the end of the third quarter. The fourth quarter opened with a Jake Elliott field goal, taking it to 32-26. Patriots came back with another 75-yard touchdown drive, Gronk getting his second of the evening, and New England leading for the first time. Philly's next drive nearly resulted in a turnover on downs, but for a 7-yard catch by Nelson Aguilar. They rolled up the field and Zach Ertz caught the ball, took 5 steps, then broke the plane of the goal line, and then the ball came out when he hit the ground. A lot was made of this one in terms of whether or not he survived the ground and whether it should or shouldn't have been made a catch, with everyone apparently forgetting that he'd taken 4 steps with the ball. That means it's a catch. Just throwing that out there. It got reviewed for some reason. It stood, but again, the 2-point attempt failed. The Patriots looked to be gearing up for another big drive, but defensive end Brandon Graham made the first and I think only sack of the game, a strip sack which Derek Barnett pounced on, letting the Eagles run the clock down again and giving them another 3 points off the boot of Elliott. Tom Brady then had 1 minute and 5 seconds and 1 timeout to go the entire length of the field and make a 2-point conversion, and that would be to tie the game, send it to overtime. 3 incomplete passes later, it wasn't looking very good, but Danny Amendola caught a 13-yard throw to keep it alive. 13 seconds remaining, the Pats were on near as down at the halfway line. Brady escaped a sack, threw an enormous Hail Mary, and as time expired, it fell incomplete. Philadelphia therefore won their first Vince Lombardi trophy, and the Patriots now tie the Denver Broncos for the most Super Bowls lost by a franchise. I'm very happy about that one. Nick Foles was named MVP. The game set a new record for total yardage in any game in the NFL ever with 1,151. Really an incredible, aggressive game plan by Philly head coach Doug Pederson, who in my mind was robbed of Coach of the Year award, when you consider that his starting MVP candidate quarterback went down with an ACL injury in week 11. He managed to completely rearrange all the systems, all the structures of the team to play around Foles' natural abilities, and frankly, it was an incredible effort all around.
Yeah, thanks for that, Jack. Sounds like an absolutely thrilling game, by the way you've described it. So, in your opinion, do you think this year's final tops last year? I mean, obviously it was incredible seeing Tom Brady's sort of record-topping masterclass last year, but I think, was it almost refreshing to see a new team win it for the first time?
Of course, absolutely. I'm a Seattle Seahawks fan. I watched Super Bowl 48 as it happened, and I'll be honest, a 43-8 victory. Yeah, it was great, but this year was absolutely incredible. I think last year's was probably better in terms of just like a pure on the field, oh my god, they came back type thing. But I think this year's was much more of the story that surrounded the game. You've got Carson Wentz, genuine MVP candidate. Like, people were still talking about him being MVP despite the injury and like just for what he'd done in those first 11 weeks. And to say he went down, and Nick Foles, who a year ago was contemplating retirement after becoming something of a just a general backup, a bit of a journeyman quarterback, to say that he then stepped up, he's put in some absolutely incredible numbers, and to get to the Super Bowl in the first place was an incredible achievement, but then to win it in one of the sort of biggest offensive games in NFL history. I mean, the defenses just didn't turn up. It wasn't really that the offenses stood tall, it was just the defenses went to sleep.
Yep.
But for it to happen in the way that it did, it's possibly my favourite Super Bowl to happen so far. Like, it was fantastic of all the ones I've watched, certainly.
Well, I'll take your word for it. I mean, I remember watching the back end of last year's, but fortunately didn't get a chance to catch this year's, which is a shame. What's next for Tom Brady, in your opinion, then? I mean, it's a question which I think many pundits out there have been asking, but how many years has he honestly got left in him, do you think? I mean, he became the oldest man to win the MVP this season, didn't he, at the age of 40 or something? But people are still seemingly questioning his physical and mental desire to continue. Can you see him continuing for a few more years at least?
He's going to keep going until his right arm falls off, and then he's going to start throwing it left-handed. Honestly, he's one of the greatest competitors in... Whatever he thinks he can do to get an advantage, he'll take. And while that might not make the games that he plays very interesting to watch, you can't deny the results it's had. I think he said he wants to play until he's about 45 or something like that, which is absolute madness as far as I'm concerned. I think a couple of seasons behind an offensive line that might not be as good as the one that he's got at the moment might change his mind on that one. Both the offensive and defensive coordinators of the Patriots have, since the Super Bowl, been signed as head coaches of I think the Indianapolis Colts and the Detroit Lions respectively, so there's a bit of a shake up happening, but I think he will play for as long as he's physically able to do so.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed he does continue to do that. I mean, I think you've only got to look at the likes of tennis and the likes of Roger Federer to show that it's not really about age, it's about what physical shape you're in and your mental desire to continue. I just wanted to touch on, is it Jay quickly, yeah. Hopefully I've pronounced that right. A London-born player who I think was traded to the Eagles by the Miami Dolphins,
yes,
was it?
Mid-season
trade. Yeah, earlier on in the season. So would you like to see more British players playing in the NFL, which is unquestionably, I think, the best league in the world? Or would you prefer us to promote the standard of American football in this country and try and hold on to some of these British superstars who end up moving over to America?
I think it is... The thing is, the NFL has... Because it is America's pastime, it's America's great game. And unless we pour, like, just hideous amounts of money, frankly, into it in this country, you're never going to get to the point where we can, like, make any effort at retaining players. Like, I don't even know of a major English-American football league, as it were. So I think you're always going to get those people who want to go and play in the NFL for these established teams, for, you know, the Philly Eagles, for whoever. It's very much an uphill battle, that would be, I think. And I think it's probably better that we let what's happening happen, because trying to fight against that, you're trying to hold back a flood, frankly. It's not going to work, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree. I can't see American football becoming particularly popular in this country anyway. I think it's predominantly an American sport, and always will be.
Yeah, if you want to play a contact sport in this country, you go and play rugby.
Exactly. We're going to move on from American football now and discuss a proper sport in the form of rugby union.
Well,
Sam is our resident expert in the studio this week. So, Sam, could you give us a rundown as to what happened in the opening round of fixtures last weekend?
Yes, Ollie. Last weekend was indeed the beginning of the Six Nations. The first game was the highly anticipated match between Wales and Scotland, with many actually backing Scotland. They've recently been doing very well. I was one who honestly was thinking that they'd... really competing for the Six Nations. Even Hugo Monier, the ex-Harlequins winger, did a poll on Twitter asking who they thought would win that match, and it was majority Scotland, but they did not live up to the hype whatsoever. It was a pretty comprehensive beating by Wales, with a final score 34-7. The Scots looked very shaky in defence, certainly, and the frankly young Wales team performed very, very well. Lee Halfpenny especially really putting in a shift, scoring the majority of their points. And our second game on Saturday was France versus Ireland. Now, if no one saw that, you should at least watch the last 10 minutes. It was a thrilling match, with Johnny Sexton scoring all the points for Ireland, and winning the match with a 45-metre drop goal to get the final score 13-15. So if he missed that, they wouldn't have won, and it just about had the legs, and it was just incredible to watch, frankly. Now, the Sunday game was obviously my favourite of the weekend, England versus Italy. Although it's quite assumed that England would win this match, it was in Rome, so it was going to be quite hard, especially considering last year, which is
exactly
a match that
we were there, weren't we?
Ollie and I went to. But yeah, England did come out on top. At certain points, I thought England were looking a bit dodgy, but the lead was never really in danger, and the Italians' fitness was waning as per usual, despite them working on it. And another thing was Ben Youngs getting injured pretty early on, and he's now out of the remainder of the Six Nations with the veteran Richard Wigglesworth. Sorry,
got there in the end. Yeah,
yeah, being brought in. The final score being 46-15 to England. So hopefully that means good things for the rest of the Six Nations for England. Now, looking to next week, the Saturday games are Ireland versus Italy in Ireland in Dublin, England versus Wales in Twickenham, which is in fact where I'm from, and that should be a great game. Obviously, it's in Twickenham. And the Sunday fixture is Scotland versus France in Murrayfield, so another good set of fixtures. Even if you're not a rugby fan, should be a good weekend.
Yeah, I'm thoroughly looking forward to it. I really enjoyed last weekend's matches. I think it's fair to say that this is probably going to be the most hotly contested Six Nations for a while now.
Definitely.
I think you already touched upon it briefly, Sam, on how Scotland's defeat to Wales was actually somewhat of a surprise, especially despite what many people, including a number of us here at URN, initially predicted. Wales' team in that game was vastly inexperienced and I think lacked a number of their key players in recent years. They had a lot of injuries, the likes of Dan Bigger, George North, both out. I think this all begs the question then as to whether it's time Wales move forward with this new breed of players and start building for the future. Or do you feel that when fit, these seemingly proven superstars should just come straight back into the team?
Well, it seems that Gatland is doing what you said initially, that they're kind of testing the future. They've got an unnamed team for the coming weekend. George North is on the bench. But the young players are still starting. People like Big R are injured, so you can't really do anything about that. But I thought Patch will play very well. I'm a fan of just Tipperick, personally.
Yeah, great player.
But he's on the bench, so clearly Gatlin thinks that he shouldn't be starting. But yeah, the young players looking very, very good. Steph Evans looked insane on the wing. So they're definitely looking forward to the future, it seems.
Yeah, I was really impressed with, I think it was Aaron Shingler as well, the back rower, who was undoubtedly man of the match in that game. I think if it's not necessarily time for these players to move on, then would you say it's Warren Gatland himself? I mean, he's been in charge for over a decade now, but he hasn't won anything for at least the last 6 to 7. I think at the minute he's in danger of creating an almost Arsene Wenger type legacy if he carries on. So what do you think about this?
Yeah, I completely agree. Well, I'm a Chelsea fan in football, so I think if you're not really winning anything, move on. And Gatlin is a good coach. I think he's good for the Lions, although that's quite Wales-centric, but that's for another day. But yeah, I think they kind of need a change, especially with these young players coming through. If he can't really do anything with them, then they need to get a move on, because Wales are a good side, notoriously are a good side, but it's just they haven't really been challenging it. It's been England, Ireland pretty much. They have had injuries, fine. George North hasn't been able to play a lot, but yeah, possibly been looking to move on.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with you. Yeah. I think even though he's definitely going to go down as one of the best Wales managers in recent history, if he carries on, he may be remembered for the wrong reasons. He may be remembered for going a decade without winning the Six Nations. So yeah, I think it's time to get out whilst he can, and so that people remember him for the right reasons. We're going to move on to Scotland now then, and I think the question really to ask is what ultimately went wrong for them.
Mate,
they were hyped up severely before the start of the tournament, weren't they? But they looked relatively toothless in attack at the weekend, from what I could see. Do you think this was just because Wales played extremely well, or are Scotland not necessarily the force to be reckoned with, like many of us suggested they were?
It was their defence looked shaky. It just wasn't there. I mean, I thought they'd be a lot more physical, bringing the game to Wales, but no, it just didn't happen. Wales were, to be fair, were on form. Hmm. And possibly Scotland felt the pressure because, as you said, there was a lot of hype. I personally thought they'd even be contesting for the Six Nations, but watching that start is definitely not true. But yeah, I don't know what happened with them, really. The thing was just their defence wasn't there, frankly.
Yeah, I agree again, Sam. I think, to be fair, I watched the game and I would put it down to just Wales playing extremely well. I mean, the first half, in general, Scotland looked fairly decent. They made quite a few line breaks. Yeah. The likes of Stuart Hogg, Hugh Jones were still at their best, it seemed. But Wales were just unbelievable. So I think, although they probably haven't shown sort of the signs of improvement that people were expecting in that game, I definitely wouldn't rule them out for the rest of the tournament. I definitely think that game at Murrayfield in a couple of weeks' time is still going to be crucial for England, and we shouldn't underestimate them. We'll move on to Ireland now then. Another relatively lacklustre performance from one of the tournament favourites. A Johnny Sexton drop goal in the 83rd minute, like you mentioned, ultimately gave them a narrow victory at the Stade de France. But what do you think this says about how much home advantage plays in the competition? I think in the rugby podcast we did, I spoke about this for a long time and how much of an impact I thought it was. But I mean, take nothing away from the French. They obviously deserve credit for the way they played in that game. But I can't help but feel like if that game had been at the Aviva Stadium, then the scoreline would have been somewhat more comfortable. Do you think, or does this prove then, that the fixture list for each team is more of a deciding factor when it comes to their chances of winning the Six Nations? Or do you feel that the best team on paper, as Ireland seemingly are this year, will ultimately pull through in the end?
I think the fixture list does have a big impact. Like last year, England not getting the Grand Slam, I think that was a lot of it was that was down to being in Dublin. If that was in Twickenham, I don't think there's any doubt in my mind that England wouldn't have won the Grand Slam. Still won the Six Nations, but didn't win the Grand Slam. Going back to Scotland, as you said, Murrayfield, that's going to have a massive impact. Playing there's always hard. But yeah, a place like, that's why even the England game against Italy was always going to be a bit dodgy, because they've got their home advantage and everyone's getting behind their players. So I think being the home team is definitely really important. And go back to last year, because it did kind of annoy me that we didn't get the Grand Slam. I think that was down to be playing in Ireland.
Yeah, exactly. I think like you said, the fact that the Ireland-England game is going to be at Twickenham this year, I think that's going to be crucial. Yeah. I think if you had to pick between playing one of Scotland and Ireland away, you'd definitely rather have a game at Murrayfield than at the Aviva Stadium. So I think, yeah, I think that says a lot about England's chances this year. We'll move on to France now then. We'll probably try and go through every team if we've got time. They're obviously under new management now with Jacques Brunel at the helm. Did you see signs that the team were improving in that game and potentially looking like the amazing French teams of the past, or do you think they've still got some way to go with such an inexperienced team before they start challenging the likes of Ireland and England for the Six Nations again?
I think it's a bit of time until they actually challenge the Six Nations itself, but the fact that they applied a lot of pressure onto Ireland, it shows already they're making big changes. I don't know if they're going to... I don't know how soon or whether at all they'll go back to their kind of glory days, as it were, of actually playing really, really world-class rugby. They are a great team, but no one's really going to be assuming that they're competing for the Six Nations. Possibly in a couple of years, who'll know, you know, they were playing very well against Ireland. We'll see how the rest of the Six Nations pans out. Probably in a couple of weeks, I might have changed my mind completely, but yeah, we'll see in a few weeks, Owls.
Yeah, I think the key for them is seeing how some of these youngsters play alongside some of their more experienced superstars, the likes of Wesley Fofana, who was one of the best players in the Six Nations for 3 or 4 years in a row, the likes of Bryce Delan, who quickly established himself on the European scene as an absolutely outstanding fullback. So when the likes of them come back into the team, combined with their new talent, I'm really interested to see how they do, especially under the leadership of Jacques Brunel, who I think is a very well-respected person. I think the French team are seemingly getting behind him, so that's going to be interesting to see. We'll touch on England now then. A brilliant victory, I think, to quick start their campaign, a lot better than the match we saw at Twickenham last year. Obviously everyone expected us to win, considering Italy are evidently still the weakest team in the competition despite showing signs of improvement, but based off the back of that performance, do you see us as clear favourites for the title, especially considering we have Ireland at Twickenham like you said and Scotland don't appear to be as strong as people first envisaged?
I don't think we'll be a clear winner. I think it'll be, again, a really entertaining series with... but I do think England will win and definitely could win. The fact that we're playing Ireland at home is a big, big factor. We definitely have the players to win. Even with the English young players, they were playing very, very well on the weekend and did in the Autumn Internationals, the ones who played there. But I don't think any teams have won three times on the trot.
No, I don't think they have. I think Wales won back-to-back under Warren Gatland. But no team's ever done that.
I think it's possible for England to do it. I hope.
I'd certainly hold them as favourites. And I think you touched on a very good point with our squad depth and the quality of players we've got. I mean, one of England's most integral players in recent years has obviously been Billy Vunipola. I just wanted to touch on the performance of Sam Simmons quickly. There was obviously a question as to who would fill the boots of Billy Vunipola. But do you think we've potentially found someone who's even better than him? Or do you think when Vunipola's back fit that he'll just walk straight back into the team?
I don't think he'll walk straight back into the team purely because they are such different players. Billy Vunipola is obviously slow, but as we saw, Simmons was so strong, really fast in the running, which obviously Vunipola is more of a power player, but he was almost like a back.
It was ridiculous.
Exactly.
I think his Exeter teammate, Jack Noel, said that he's the quicker than him, or the quickest person in the Exeter team,
I wouldn't be surprised,
at least.
To be honest. He's playing like a New Zealander. It's amazing, but we do definitely miss Billy Vunipola at that eight role, but it will be interesting to see when he's fit what happens.
Yeah, like you said, Sam, as well, I think they play two completely different roles, and I think the good thing about that is that Eddie Jones can potentially adapt his team selection based on the team we're playing. If we're going in against New Zealand, I would want Sam Simmons playing. I would want to play New Zealand at their own game. But if it's going to be a tighter affair against the likes of Ireland, where there's going to be a lot of slow crash balls up, I'd prefer Billy Vunipola to place. But I think ultimately, I think that's just a good thing for England in general, and
it
gives weight to the quality of their squad depth. So leading into that, a quick question, which I'll open up to the others in the studio. Based off the first round of results and looking at the fixtures In future weeks. Who do you think is going to win the Six Nations?
I was less convinced about this beforehand, but my original choice was England. I'm definitely going to stick with that. I think it's become more solid, solidified for these first results. I mean, I think we were talking about Scotland and Ireland being the two to challenge them, really. Obviously, Scotland completely folded against Wales, and Ireland didn't exactly look convincing in their win against France. So I think that all bodes well for England. The one thing I would say is that obviously the Welsh always get themselves very hyped up for a match against England. So a resurgent Wales could be a threat to England if we have an off day. I'm sure Eddie Jones will be aware of that and will be prepping them hard to ensure that that doesn't happen. But yeah, I think if Wales can get the balance right between experience and youthful energy, it could be a deadly team. And potentially, I think you could be looking at Wales as finishing second or third now with the form they demonstrated in their first match.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think Wales, they always are a problem to the English, but I think, yeah, England will win it. If we put in a convincing match against Wales, then definitely we'll win. So...
Yeah, I've got to echo what the other guys have said. I mean, I remember about this time last year, I got asked if, because England was still on their streak at the time, and I remember saying that because we had Ireland, but we had them at Murrayfield, that I didn't think we'd get it done there. I'm still convinced that if we had that at Twickenham, we would have beaten New Zealand's record, and I think it's still true. I think we've got a very, very solid side that can battle with the best of them.
Yeah, I completely agree with all of you guys, especially about the idea of the streak. It's a shame that it's not carrying on going, to be honest, because I think we've won our other five matches since then as well, so we could have potentially seen us on a streak of maybe 25-26. But yeah, that being said, I'm going to stick with England as favourites for the title. I think we're by far and away the second best team in the world. The only team better than us is New Zealand, and I'm thoroughly looking forward to seeing how we get on against them. I think that just about wraps up our rugby talk for today then. Tune in next week, as I'm sure we'll be analysing this weekend's fixtures and, fingers crossed, be discussing an England victory over Wales. It's time for another bit of tennis discussion now, as I'm sure you've become accustomed to in recent weeks. Great Britain, were unable to replicate their success in the Davis Cup in recent years, as they were beaten 3-1 by Spain in Marbella. They were plagued by injuries, though, to both of their main singles players, with Andy Murray out injured, and Kyle Edmund still recovering from his hip problems, which ultimately saw him lose in the Australian Open semi-final. There was, however, an outstanding debut for Cameron Norrie, which some pundits have hailed as the best of all time. One of URN's own, in Naomi Steen, was actually lucky enough to go to some of the matches live, so let's have a listen to what she made of the events which unfolded.
This is URN Sport.
So, I was lucky enough to be able to go to the Davis Cup last weekend, and Great Britain were playing Spain. And it was interesting because we didn't have Andy Murray, we didn't have Kyle Edmund because he's now injured, because he suffered an injury in the Australian Open semi-final, I think it was. And we were left with Cameron Norrie to play and represent us against Spain on clay in Spain. So the chances were against us with Liam Brody, of course, and Jamie Murray and Dom Inglot in the doubles. We lost to Spain 3-1. Three matches to one. We lost it on the Sunday. We could have lost it beforehand on the Saturday, but actually Cameron Norrie managed to pull off a stunning comeback on Friday, and he beat Bautista Agu in five sets. And it's really nice to see, because although I didn't go on Friday, unfortunately, I went on Saturday and Sunday, I heard what happened, and I was lucky enough to see Norrie play on Sunday, and he got extremely close to winning again when he lost the match to Ramos Vinolas on Sunday. It was 3-1, and two of the sets he lost were unfortunately on tiebreaks, so he really came very close, and it was a very competitive match. And it was nice to see, because Cameron Norrie has only been professional for about a year. He's very young, so the future is looking bright. This was, of course, on clay, so the fact that Norrie actually beat Bautista Agu on Friday in five sets, making his clay debut, international professional debut, it's incredible. And his forehand looks really, really good. To see it live was incredible. It was so fast and powerful. And he's definitely got a great shot there. His backhand is okay, but his forehand is really, really promising. And I think he just needs to finish up on his serve, and he's really a player to watch for the future. It was unfortunate that Dom Inglot and Jamie Murray couldn't perform better on Saturday, because Spain won the doubles quite easily in straight sets, and if we had won that match, who knows what would have happened in the match on Sunday. But it was unfortunately three matches to one, and Spain won, but it was expected. We were expected to lose three matches to love without Murray and Edmund. There was a possibility Edmund would play on Sunday if we had a chance to win the tie, but we didn't. But the fact is, Cameron Norrie is only about 21 or 22 years old, and he looks so good on clay, and he's still so young, so there's so much potential for him, and the future is bright for a fresh British player, which is really nice to see. So I'm quite excited to see more of him in the future. Spain were... they were struggling. Ramos Vinolas could have easily lost the sets on tie breaks. He was looking nervous, and understandably, because Norrie put up a good fight, and the atmosphere was incredible. All the Brits, there were a lot of British people at the tennis, and a lot of people supporting Norrie, and it was great to see, because I think tennis needs this. Because without Andy Murray, yes, you've got Daniel Evans, well, not now, but you've got Daniel Evans and Carl Edmonds, who did well in the Australian, obviously. But Cameron Norrie is ranked 114 in the world. So it shows you how well he played, because for a player not to be in the top 100 and to be a top 20, 30 ranked player, really impressive. So it's a pity, I think, that the Davis Cup doesn't help for ranking points, because Norrie could have gained quite a few of that. And it's good that his comeback shows that he doesn't give up. Five sets on clay is tough, and he was two sets down as well, so he came from two sets down to win the set, to win the match 3-2. Amen. And it was really, really good.
This is URN Sport.
So thanks to Naomi for her thoughts on that. We're going to move from one expert to another now, though, so I'm going to open this one up to you, Matt. So what do you make of Cameron Norrie? Do you think we found another potential British superstar to go alongside Carl Edmund, especially considering he's at the ideal age, I would say, of 22? Or do you think we're too quick to judge someone off the back of one victory?
We're too quick to judge somebody. We've seen the likes of James Ward have big victories before in the Davis Cup. Dan Evans, yeah. They haven't pushed on from them. They're still about 200 in the world, you know. So I think you can get excited about a player once they have a really good run at a big tournament. So if they have a good run at a Masters or a Grand Slam, yeah, like Kyle Edmund did, and you think, well, he's shown proven quality to get through several rounds of competition, that shows a lot more than you know, Cameron Norrie having to have quite a good day, and Batista Agut having a bit of an off day, and him still only scraping through in five sets says, I think, more about Batista Agut having a bad day than Cameron Norrie sort of going to be a top 10 player. I don't think it's going to happen. Norrie's a perfectly decent player. I think he's capable of being sort of solid top 80 maybe, but I don't think he's capable of reaching the heights that Carl Edmund and Andy Murray are. Just simply because he doesn't have the game to. He's a pretty solid player. Does not particularly weak in any respect, but he hasn't got the weapons that Murray and Edmund have to take them down.
Yeah, I was literally about to say what you just did there, Matt. I watched the highlights of the game, and for me, he just doesn't possess any of the necessary credentials to become a world-class player. I think the key for Carl Edmund, when we've touched on him in previous weeks, is that he's got these weapons. He's got the serve. He's got the forehand.
Exactly.
Cameron Norrie showed the fight. He arguably showed a bit of the defence. I mean, there was a lot of long rallies in some of those games.
I think he showed great mental strength, yeah. But I watched his match, and I mean, he played well undoubtedly, but I didn't look at that match and think, wow, what a backhand or what a forehand. I just thought he was a pretty solid player, had a good day, and Batista Agut had a bit of an off day. And I mean, just touch upon Edmund's big weapon in his serve and his forehand, and then Murray's got his movement, a phenomenal backhand, and general exceptional play across the board. So yeah, I think I think it's a bit of a trait in British sport that we get very excited about a young player doing well on one occasion. Come back to me when he's got to the Grand Slam semi-finals like Kyleman has, and then I'll get a bit more excited, I think.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm sure we'd love to both be proven wrong, but
absolutely.
As it happens, I can't really see him going too far. Moving on then, I think this is a much tougher question for you, Matt. This is something which I feel quite strongly about, and having watched tennis in recent years, I definitely feel strongly about it. Do you think the Davis Cup demands a format change? I mean, at present, it's possible for one player to single-handedly win the tie for their respective country, as we've frequently seen the likes of Andy Murray do in 2015, along with the likes of Novak Djokovic and Roger Federer. I mean, Murray in 2015 regularly played and won two single matches and played a doubles match with his brother, which culminated in victory despite the other two British players losing. And considering the Davis Cup is essentially attempting to give a country bragging rights to declare themselves the best tennis nation in the world, can we really support this view when one player can single-handedly make so much of a difference?
I suppose you could introduce regulations as to what, you know, as the amount of matches they could play, and say perhaps that not allowing Tan and Andy Murray to play in a doubles match. I mean, obviously, we're relatively strong in our doubles contingent. It was a bit of a surprise losing, actually, because Jamie Murray is a fantastic doubles player. Dom the Bomb Inglot is also a great player with a big serve. But yeah, I mean, obviously it benefits us because Murray could, what he did for a couple of years was basically win his two singles matches easily, and then him and his brother would just win the doubles match very comfortably. So that benefits us, but I don't think it's good for the sport. And I think that it's difficult one to rejig, because obviously what they're attempting to do with the Davis Cup is make an individual sport a team sport,
yeah,
which is quite a difficult thing to do, really. And I don't know. I think maybe you could restrict the amount of matches they could play, perhaps, or you could say that you can put forward only every player can only play in one match, so you'd have to have four separate singles players and then two doubles players. So that might make it more of a team competition, but then that might lose a bit of the interest because the big names will be playing so much, so people might be less inclined to turn out and watch the matches. So it could definitely have a double effect, I think.
This is URN Sport.